I'm sitting down with Lynn Murphy today, a founder of the Halifax Elderberries, former chair of the Pride Week Committee, and former chair of the Gay Alliance Community. We're going to talk about the queer book sale that is happening this weekend, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I just want to let you all kind of get to know Lynn, this super cool woman who I've had the privilege of talking to a bit this afternoon. So you were born in Summerside, PEI, in 1946. What was it like growing up on a farm on such a small island so long ago?
Wow. Well, it was the only life that I knew. We lived on a farm about 10 miles out of Summerside, and my two uncles and an aunt lived on the adjoining farm, so we were kind of we worked together. It was a kind of cooperative venture.
I've never actually been to PEI myself. I was technically there when I was a baby, but I don't think that counts because I don't have any memories from being there. But I would love to go someday. And I think you mentioned you don't visit too often, but you were there just a few years ago?
I was there about 3 years ago. My brother still lives on the island and has one of the houses, the house that belonged to my uncle. And so when I was better able to travel, I used to go over probably about once a year. But now that I use a walker, it's a little harder to get around. And so I'm very lazy and I stay home.
You know, I would be staying home too. Honestly, traveling is so hard anyway, whether you use a walker or not, it seems. Do you notice a change maybe in the level of tolerance in your home place of PEI compared to when you grew up? Like, what things have changed in PEI in Summerside, and what things maybe have stayed the same?
Well, in terms of the situation of LGBTQ people, I don't really know anything about the very small gay community on the island. When I was a kid, I had no knowledge of gay people at all. When I went to college, there was one employee of the college who was widely known to be gay. And although we didn't even have the word gay then, and there was an annual party of gay people, as we would say now, and in Charlottetown. I don't know if there was anything like violence towards the community. It was a kind of, in his case anyway, a sort of amused tolerance. But he was an odd duck, to be sure.
What was his name?
I've been trying to remember, and I can't.
Fair enough. We'll have to go back through the yearbooks and see if we can find him someday. So you are a librarian. When did you realize that, when did you fall in love with books and realize that that's what you wanted to do for the rest of your life?
Well, I was not an early reader, but I had people in the family who would read to me. My mother, my aunt, who used to live with us off and on, she was my mother's aunt, and they would read to me out of the children's page of the newspaper. And so I liked the idea of reading, but I wasn't very good at it until grade two, but I had a good memory. And so I memorized the book. Oh. And then when the teacher said read, I would say, "Come, Jane, look at Spot. He is playing with Puff." Puff being a little cat, Spot probably trying to eat him.
That's so fun.
But once I caught on to the trick of reading, it was good. My mother would put me out out the back door, go and play in the yard, and I would sneak in the front door. In the way of farmhouses on the island, the front door was very seldom used. Everybody come in through the back door. And I would sneak in the front door and very quietly sit down in the room, which was almost like a parlor because you lived in the kitchen. And so I would be in the room quietly reading a book that I didn't understand much more than about half of it. There were a couple of mysteries there. There was a book about Germany in the 30s and reporters trying to report on Hitler. I had no idea who Hitler was. I was in grade 4, My parents had had quite enough of Hitler before I was born. So.
Wonderful.
And there was no libraries.
There,
I didn't know there was such a thing as a library. It was like one of the things that you read about that they had, like in maybe in Boston, probably they had libraries. I don't think I even knew too much about Halifax. I might have thought maybe they'd have a little library, but in fact, there was a very small library in Kensington, which was a town about two or three miles away from where we lived. And once I got old enough to be trusted to walk to Kensington by myself, and I would take out as many books as the librarian would allow me to have, which was about 8, and under strict orders to get at least a couple of things that I'd like to read, my mother would say. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Oh, my goodness. It's so sad nowadays where you see libraries that are closing. When it wasn't even that long ago where, you know, there weren't even libraries. I know my mom works at an elementary school, and they were just getting rid of all of the books in favor of tablets. It was...
Oh, my God, it's nuts.
It is nuts.
Getting rid of books, you're bringing up a generation of illiterates.
You're right, yeah. It's you know, you laugh at it, but like it's true. It's very sad to see. I hope that we can maybe inspire a resurgence of book reading. I know I maybe fell out of love with reading after university when they made you do it so much, but I'm just starting to get back into it now. So I would love it for more people to maybe, you know, if you see books being donated, grab them so that they don't go to waste, and then maybe start up a new library. We should start our own library.
Well, we have our own library, and it's the public library. You know, we don't need to start up our own individual libraries, including we don't need to start up special separate gay libraries, because if LGBTQ-related books are not being stocked by the public library, you go and tell them that. You say, we have a community who are interested in these books, and you have an obligation to provide them. Well, you know, you can be a little more diplomatic than that, but essentially, the gay community is part of the library's public, and not just people who are gay, but there's our friends and relations and the people who work with us, and It's part of the life, the city, the province, the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. I completely agree. I haven't been to the public library in a little while, but I'm going to have to go back there soon.
Yes.
I spent a lot of time there in university writing many papers that I'll probably never, ever read again. But I need to find more use for it than that. I know you said you can't really pick a favorite book earlier, but is there any book that maybe you can think that would help gay youth understand maybe a bit more about their history, or anything that you can maybe think of in regards to that?
I feel out of touch with what gay youth would already know, because it's a much more open society than it was When I was coming out, when was I coming out home? In 1980 or late 70s or 80? That's getting to be a long time ago now. And I was a late bloomer too. Young people now have so many
resources.
No, I'm thinking of the examples of LGBTQ people, like in the media. You know, you look at in just ordinary entertainment, for instance. I know they're not on anymore, but Will and Grace. Mm-hmm. Oh, for goodness sake, that's a totally gay show. And it wasn't marketed just to the gay community. It was a show for everybody. And lots of people watched it. And maybe it made some people change their ideas. And in terms of actors and actresses, who have gradually come out of the closet, or trans people also. Elliot Page as a local example.
There are definitely a lot more role models to find these days. You don't have to kind of go searching. They're not exactly coded as being gay. Like, they're just openly gay, and that's a really wonderful thing that we get to finally experience. How old were you when you came out?
Oh, my. Let me see. Well, it would be in the very late 70s, so 46, 56, 66, 76, in my 30s.
Mm. Cool. And what prompted you to finally come out and stop, you know, hiding that part of yourself?
Well, I wasn't exactly hiding, but I had just not come up against it, I guess. I was somewhat aware of gay issues because, usually we'll talk about Fortune in Men's Eyes, which was a Canadian film about this guy goes to prison, and he is a straight man, but he's befriended by the local prison drag queen, who sort of teaches him about what it's like to be gay, what it's like to be a drag person. Drag people did not have a very positive reputation within, even within the LGBTQ community at that time. And so I saw that film, and I had a very close friend who I knew was gay, and who, in the fashion of that time, was an illegal person because he smoked marijuana long before it was legal. And when I saw this film about a young gay man being tormented and raped in prison, I thought, oh my God, that could be Stephen. And so I immediately became converted to the cause of gay rights, became a little bit aware of people in the community at that time. And also, I was becoming aware of the feminist movement, which had a lot of lesbians taking a very positive part in the women's movement. And so between those two things, I became very positive towards the community. And then, of course, I met this wonderful woman, long gone to California, but nevertheless, it was a very important relationship to me.
Did you guys keep in touch after she went to California?
No.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Oh, well, no, we had split up, you know, long before that, but I've seen her once since she went to California. She came back for a visit to some other women that I knew, and I was at their house for coffee.
Well, you guys seem to still have a nice relationship, like nothing, there's no bad blood.
No. I know other people who have had relationships where once they split up, there was very negative feeling. Which I think is a real shame, but, you know, people have the emotions that they have. But for us, there was no bad blood. Sorrow in the beginning. Oh, my goodness. There was a conference here. This was before there was any such thing as Pride Weeks in Halifax. And there was a national gay rights conference in Halifax. And I can't tell you when it was, except it was in the late 70s. And so, and it was the first march. We didn't say parade then. We were definite that this was a political movement and this was a march. Anyway, the night before the march, this woman who was my first woman love, she broke up with me. So here we are marching down the street, and me with the tears pouring down my face because I was so brokenhearted. Anyway.
I can understand that. I feel like you never forget your first woman love, for sure. I know we've all had our share of heartbreak, but also a lot of joy. So there's always, I mean, with any relationship or with any kind of person, there's always the heartbreak when things don't work out, but then there's the joy when things do. You mentioned your late husband, who is also a very active member within these different marches and communities and committees. Yeah. Would you like to talk a little bit about him and your love together?
We lived in the same building, which has now been torn down on South Street. But we didn't know each other until after he moved out. and then he came back to a party at my upstairs neighbor's, and we met there. I don't really know what to say. We were both active in the gay community, and people didn't know what to make of us. And I don't know. Maybe we didn't know what to make of ourselves either. But our social life was with other members of the community, and there was the gay club at that time, and we did a lot of socializing there. And meetings, lots of meetings. he was a good bit older than me, and eventually through health problems, stop smoking now. That's my word of advice. He developed COPD, which is pulmonary disease. And he spent the last 6 years of his life in the hospital. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. I know it's probably not super easy to talk about, even if it's been a little bit of time.
It's been a long time. It's been more than 15 years since he died.
Something we mentioned already, Fortune in Men's Eyes, how it radicalized you to start fighting for queer rights. So what other maybe films, TV shows, or plays do you think can shift the way that people think about queer issues and even radicalize them to fight for us?
My exposure to LGBT movies is old, you know. I haven't seen anything modern, and so some of the things that I saw, Victor Victoria, for instance, a good one, and Cabaret, his is full of gay content.
I know for me, a lot of the media that helped me kind of figure out my identity was older gay media, like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I think I realized I might not be super straight when I developed a crush on Frankenfurter. I knew I was probably not going to be straight as an arrow with that kind of start, as well as like David Bowie in Labyrinth. Another, again, men in makeup and flamboyant costumes was very important for my upbringing.
Way back when there used to be a name for women who hung out with gay men, which I can't even remember now. And it was a kind of pejorative name in a way. But I guess in a sense that might have been an earlier start than Fortune in Men's Eyes, because I did have gay male friends. I didn't always know at the top of my head that they were gay, but I think it's a certain subliminal level that I knew. They certainly weren't coming on to me anyway.
Is the term hag?
That's hag, yes.
Yep.
That's it.
I was at a little get-together last night for another friend's birthday, and we were talking about, you know, straight women hanging out with gay men and the different terms. Apparently fruit flies is another one that
No, I never heard that at the time.
Maybe they just keep coming up with new things. I think it was fruit flies and F-slur, hag, you know, that they rhyme. That was one as well. I can't remember the other ones now, but I think fruit flies was the funniest one that I heard last night. So I, hags are very important for the community. So we appreciate those hags. I think they...
No, and it was a kind of, it was an early form of birth control, wasn't it? You hung out with these very nice, very charming young men. Who had no sexual interest in you whatsoever.
That's genius. Although now, I guess another kind of birth control is being in a lesbian relationship. I know when I talk to people about having a house one day, you know, how we probably don't need a big house because it's not like we're going to accidentally have kids anytime soon. So we're not too too concerned about
that. Well, you're not going to accidentally have kids, but... Besides the lesbians who had children before they found out that they were lesbians, but there are also women who wanted to have children, either adopted or chose another method of becoming pregnant. So never say never. You might end up with half a dozen children.
Oh my.
All right, maybe two.
Two, just so that, you know, one isn't all by themselves.
Yeah.
But I could see myself adopting one day. I used to work at a maternity store, so after seeing, you know, what the body goes through during pregnancy, I don't know if I'm physically or mentally prepared for that kind of experience, I'll say. So the idea of bisexuality has shifted so much in the last few decades, where it was once seen as something that didn't exist, and now more people than ever are openly identifying with it, as well as other orientations. What did it feel like to, you know, have to hear that, you know, people saying bisexuality isn't real when you yourself identify as bisexual and knew that you kind of liked men and women? And how have you seen views within and also outside of the community change on the idea of, you know, liking two or more genders?
Well, certainly when I was first coming into the community, it was well known that there was no such thing as a bisexual, because a bisexual was just a person who was too... whether scared or lying to themselves about being gay. But it didn't really exist. And so that was the attitude, I think, within the community as well. And in my case, I just kind of lasted them out because 44 years in the community. And I still haven't become a full-time lesbian, so it's probably not going to happen now.
No, probably not. I know I always used to think, and maybe this was a little, you know, biphobic of me, like internalized biphobia. Like, I wish I could be a lesbian. I wish I wasn't attracted to men. I wouldn't be attracted to men if I had the choice. If I had the choice, I would absolutely stay clear of those guys. I'm just kidding to all of my male listeners. I love you very much. but yeah, again, sometimes that kind of homophobia or biphobia, it can be internalized. But yeah. I mean, we have Lynn here to prove it. Guys, it's not a phase.
It's not a phase. You know, after a while, after my ill-fated first experience, and I certainly knew other lesbians. But then it's who you meet, it's who you become emotionally attached to. To me, it didn't seem as though I was attached to a specific gender. I was attached to a specific person. And so that was, and, you know, the next time, could be the same gender, could be the opposite gender.
Yeah. I totally felt the exact same way. So it's kind of cool to see, you know, other people, especially gay elders, talking about having the same feelings that, you know, keep happening. And, you know, that, you know, it's not something you can control. It's not something that you choose. It's just how you view love. And that's just kind of how you are.
I think maybe that there's still a feeling within the, particularly within the lesbian community, I could be wrong, that you haven't committed to, you haven't committed to being gay, you haven't committed to being a lesbian, and I mean, I think that's true because I'm not a lesbian. Very lesbian positive, but that's a different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, how are you supposed to commit to being a full lesbian if that's not who you are? And I think now it's more seen that there's less of a divide and less of, you know, a feeling of superiority between, like, lesbians and bisexuals. I think that they are, positive change is happening, but there's still a lot of work left to be done in fully accepting everyone in the community. As long as we're, like, infighting, I mean, that's not going to help us make any positive change. If we're just like, well, you're not as gay as me, so I am the supreme gay.
Yeah, well, I don't know to what extent there are still people who feel like that. I certainly did feel, and even perhaps I still do feel, to a certain extent, that the lesbian separatists have kind of led the struggle for a long time. And deserve a huge amount of credit for doing that, and sometimes at considerable cost to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely have a lot to thank lesbian separatists, as well as you and your generation and the things that you fought for When it was, you know, it's still not safe today, but it was definitely much more dangerous back then. And you actually participated in the jury room protest, which is referred to as the Stonewall of Halifax. Can you tell us about that day and how it maybe helped shape the infrastructure of the city and how it treats gay patrons and gay residents?
Well, I don't know if I can say too much about how it changed the way that people were treated, but I can tell you about my experience of the jury room protest. At that time, this was before I had any lesbian-specific relationships, and so I was dating a young prof from St. Mary's at the time, and so Saturday night was coming up, and when we traditionally went out, and he said, what would you like to do? We could go to a movie. This was before the days of videos in the home, and or we could go to a restaurant, or what would you like to do? And I said, well, the gay people, those others, are having a protest at the jury room. And I'd like to go to the protest. Oh, he said, well, we could do that. And so we toddled off down to the protest, and somebody handed us a picket, and we marched around in circles in front of the jury room door for a while, and then eventually, probably I should give a little background. The jury room had become a kind of place where gay people felt more or less comfortable, and you could go in there and you could have a beer and whatever. And the staff pretty well knew who we, well, not we, because I wasn't part of it at that time, but pretty well knew who everybody was. Well, the management did not like the place becoming known as a gay hangout, and so they told the staff not to serve any gay people. And the staff were not, this was our take at the time anyway, the staff were not happy with this, but, you know, you have to have a job after all, and so they performed as required, and so then there was the protest. So we marched around in circles for a while, and then there was already a gay club on Barrington Street. Was it called Groomers already at this time? I think maybe. I'm not sure. Anyway, it was a gay club, and it was on Barrington Street. And somebody from the club came up to the protest and said, when you're ready to break up for the evening, come on down to the club. So we went down to the club, walked in the door. First person we met was my friend Stephen, the marijuana smoker. God love you, Stephen. He has been dead for several years now. And so that was my first actual political activity related to the gay community.
That is excellent. What a great story. It seems like, you know, it wasn't too traumatic, thankfully.
And high quality of young prof at St. Mary's, too. I always feel as I feel too excited about giving him credit for, you know, being willing to go, because it's only what he should have done, in a way, that straight men ought to be supporting gay struggles. But at the same time, St. Mary's was not the liberal institution that we now know and love. It was still at that time, I think, managed by the Jesuits. And it was not a gay-positive place, and he was a young prof who did not have tenure. And so you're just taking the chance by going down right in front of the windows of the Chronicle Herald, taking part in the protest. And by the way, the Chronicle Herald said nothing. Here was this protest happening right in front of their very windows. Not a word about it in the paper. And about 10 days later, one of their, not even a reporter, but a columnist, put in some remark about the protest, and it was, you know, kind of positive remark. And I said to one of my lesbian friends, I said, he wasn't taking a very obvious stand in favor of the community, was he? She said, I know him. He probably spent those whole 10 days fighting to be allowed to make those few positive remarks in his column.
Wow.
So you don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but she knew what was going on behind the scenes because she knew him.
Yeah, that's some really good perspective, because I know it's so easy to be like, well, how come they haven't done this yet? Like, they have their own wheels and their own red tape that they have to cut through. So I guess we just need to be a little bit more, I guess, you know, patient or understanding, but also we need to, you know, keep demanding more and more from the news, from our media outlets, to get even more, you know, representation.
Well, and it's not just that. It's so so omnipresent, you know, the state of homophobia, or at the least unawareness. Because a friend of mine, she was talking about going to the doctor. She said, oh my God, we spent half the appointment going into what form of birth control was I using? And I said, well, you didn't tell him. And she said, well, no, you never know how safe it is. And so there was this whole dance around the best form of birth control, which she did not need or want. And this was before AIDS, but when AIDS came along, there were the issues of a lot of guys, when it came to that point where they were seriously ill with AIDS, they went back to their birth families because that was where they could go to get support. However, in some cases, unwillingly, home is where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. And so what happened in some cases was the family would take over. They would completely lock out the gay partner. They would say that they weren't allowed to visit in the hospital. They would get the keys from their son or brother or whoever and change the locks on the apartment, or they would go in and take things out of the place which the guys had bought together. So it was tough. People used to be evicted by their landlords. And we look at the things that are happening in the States, and things are worse than they were 40 years ago in some ways, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, are they worse? Well, as bad anyway.
Yeah, definitely not good. We're not looking for worse, but it should be better.
The violence towards, particularly towards trans people, in the States is very, very bad.
Mm-hmm.
trans people being the most visible, I guess, members of the community to members of the public who really know nothing about gay people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a frightening world that we seem to be living in with this rise of alt-right ideas. But I mean, trans people have been around for so long. Marsha P. Johnson, who is credited with throwing the first brick at Stonewall, was a drag queen and a trans woman. So we would absolutely be nowhere today without trans women, especially, and trans men, and trans people of color, specifically, as well.
Yep.
So we have lots of people we have to credit, and also try to keep them safe, especially if you are a straight person. You got to use that privilege, stand up for your queer friends, your gay friends, because they need you now more than ever. Use your voice whenever you can. I want to ask you, of your work in the LGBTQ+ community, what are you the most proud of?
Gay Alliance for Equality, which later became the Gay and Lesbian Association of Nova Scotia. It folded in the 90s, and I will go into the shirtlessness issue, which could take us an hour all by itself. But the association folded after 25 years or so. And so I was the chair of the Pride Committee that year. And we had a meeting and people said, well, let's not bother with Pride this year. We don't have too much to be proud of because look how we let our association be torn apart by this one issue. And, let's just forget about it. And it was bad. I was, I had a meeting scheduled with one of the men who was somewhat of a leader, I think, in the community and at a bar. And a woman who had been, well, I guess I can say it was Jane Kansas, who has just died very recently. And Jane had been on the opposite side of the shirtlessness issue from this guy. So Jane had, by accident, come to this bar the same time as I did, about half an hour before we were to meet this fellow. I was to meet this fellow. Jane and I sat down and started talking. The guy came in. He saw me sitting with Jane. He walked right past the table where we were sitting and made like a circle of the bar and walked out the door. Didn't meet me, didn't want to see me. Things were quite negative at that time. I want to say something very positive about the Leathermen, who had their own small organization at that time. They had almost all been on the opposite side of the shirtlessness issue, opposite from me and Jane, but they rallied around Pride Week. They took part in Pride Week. They were the, several of them had motorcycles and they came around with their motorcycles. They were a kind of guard of honor. And before this, we had always had the big Pride events at the club. And we said, oh yes, the club is so kind to us and they give us money to support Pride Week. Well, as we discovered when we did some of these events ourselves, like a dance, or we were actually making a little bit of money. We were the ones who had been bringing customers into the club at a kind of dead part of the week. So we actually made a profit from Pride Week. I think it was $115. But we didn't go into the hole. That was the thing. And we didn't have to go around, you know, begging the more prosperous members to, oh, please, please give us $20 to see us out of the hole. No, we actually, we had a good Pride Week. We had a good turnout, as the numbers would count then. Wouldn't sound like much just nowadays. And we actually made a little bit of money. And that was, I think, the best thing that I ever did was to coordinate that Pride Week at a time when we were really low, really low. A lot of distrust of each other and a lot of negative feelings and people not speaking to each other and so on and so on. But we pulled it off, and it gave the example of even in bad times we had been able to do something together. And by the time the next Pride Week rolled around, which was, I wasn't coordinating it then, but by the time the next Pride Week rolled around, there was no question about whether we should do it.
That is so wonderful. Thank you so much for telling me about that. That sounds like quite the experience. Lots of ups and downs there, but it's so cool that you managed to, you know, pull through and pull that off. And we are so much better for it.
And, of course, it certainly wasn't just me, because there was a whole committee of probably about a dozen people who were working on this, let alone entertainers who, I believe there was a talent event of some kind. It's hard to remember now. But entertainers who were part of it, the drag people especially, but others as well.
So the first Cube book sale is happening this weekend.
Yes.
You seem very excited about, what are you most looking forward to? And are there any, I think you said, there's no one in particular, no author or book that you should look forward to, but to go in with, I guess, an open mind and pick through and see what you can grab. So what are you most looking forward to about this book sale?
Well, first of all, you have to guarantee and promise me that my sister will not be allowed to listen to this radio show. Because my sister has a rule, you're not going to go out and buy more books, are you? Yes, I probably am. But I'm also beginning to come to grips with downsizing. And I have religiously gone through my book collection to see what LGBT, whatever other letters of the alphabet, that I could bear to part with. And so I put about 30 books into the book sale.
Wow.
And I think I'll probably be able to come home with like half a dozen or so. So it will even out.
Well,
but if she saw me bringing more books into the house, what's the library for? You could go and borrow them.
Yeah, well,
course, but they'd make me take them back in 3 weeks.
Well, I hope I'm lucky enough to pick up a book that you once owned.
Oh, my goodness. I hope you are, too. I'll show you the box that's just on the verge of going. I'll collect money.
All right. Wonderful. All right. So we don't have too much time left. So since we are running out of time, are you able to tell us anything about your book that you're working on?
I've been working on this book off and on for 20 years, and it's based on a true crime that happened outside of Yarmouth in the year 1799. It was still slavery time in Nova Scotia. There was not a lot of slavery, but there was some. And in this case, a young woman who was held enslaved on a farm became, in ways that were not too clear, but somebody reported it to the authorities in Yarmouth, and there was an investigation. And members of the slaveholder's family were brought to trial, at least three of them, and it might have been four. Now, they were all acquitted. So, but on the other hand, considering that it was 1799 or 1800 by the time the trial came around, at least they were arrested and they were put on trial, which is probably more than one might have expected for that time. Mm-hmm. And so the book that I'm writing is told from the point of view of a young woman who has come out from England to marry the farmer next door to the family where this young woman was killed. So that's what I've been working on for quite a long time. And another woman wrote, in the interim, wrote a book about the same case, which I have not dared to read because if I read it, then subconsciously, no doubt, I will take in some of what she has written, and it would be plagiarism.
Ah, yes, plagiarism.
Plagiarism, unintentional, but so that's why I haven't read her book.
Yeah.
Which is called Jude and Diana. Jude being the woman who was killed and Diana, her sister, who were real people at the time.
Oh.
But my book is more, you know, much more light in approach.
All right. Well, I hope you finish it, and when you finish it, I will be very excited to read it. So thank you so much for allowing me to come to your beautiful home and talk to you and share your history with myself and also with the listeners at home. Is there anything that you wanted to say before, or anything you want to say about the book sale, or anything you want to finish up with?
Can't think of anything. The minute you're out the door, I'll have half a dozen things.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been Lynn Murphy talking with me, your host, Nicole Keeping, on Something Sapphic, promoting the Q book sale happening this weekend. So on Sunday, January 22nd, from 1 to 4 p.m., the Elderberries Q book sale. Here's how it works. You donate 2 SLGBTQ+ books that you have loved and now should be out entertaining and enlightening others to make room on your bookshelf. Then on the 22nd, you and everyone come to the book sale to buy books for a buck or two each. Porn? Sure, it'll go on its own table. To donate books, books may be dropped off on or before January 20th at Venus Envy, 1727 Barrington Street, 7 days a week from 11 to 6, or in the North End, Halifax by arrangement. Email elderberries-books@bonmot.ca. There will be book signings by Bruce Bishop and Lynette Richards, and Venus Envy may have a table up. Prices, unless otherwise marked, hardcover $2, magazines and soft color $1. Pay what you can starting at 4 over at 4:30. So, proceeds go to the Elderberries and Radstorm, and this will be held at Radstorm 2177 Gottingen Street. If you have any questions, email elderberries-books@bonmot.ca. Again, the Queer Book Sale is happening this Sunday, January 22nd, from 1 to 4 p.m. at Radstorm on 2177 Gottingen Street. Make sure you go out and tell someone you love them today. Thank you so much for listening.